In the twisting catacombs and ruins of the Necromunda Underhive, there are those who use their skills and knowledge navigating the tunnels to earn their living guiding gangs through peril to new opportunities. So grab your ammo and your respirator and join us on The Dome Runners.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Dome Runners. I am your host, Crimson Oracle. I also go by Ian, and today we have a very special episode dedicated to playing Necromunda in isolation. I speak with Ian Douglas about his solo play supplement, Into the Dark. Next episode, we'll continue this topic with an exploration of playing remotely with friends. But first, I wanted to take a moment, as many in the community have, on their various platforms, to acknowledge the present circumstances in the hobby. A little over a week ago, Games Workshop released a short and to-the-point statement that reads as follows. Warhammer is for everyone. One of the great powers of our hobby is its ability to bring people together in common cause, to build bonds and friendships that cross divides. We believe in and support a community united by shared values of mutual kindness and respect. Our fantasy settings are grim and dark, but that's not a reflection of who we are or how we feel the real world should be. We will never accept nor condone any form of prejudice, hatred, or abuse in our company or in the Warhammer hobby. We'll continue to diversify the cast of characters we portray through miniatures, art, and storytelling so everyone can find representation and heroes they can relate to. And if you feel the same, wherever and whoever you are, we're glad you're part of the Warhammer community. And if not, you will not be missed. In most cases, I've personally not been impressed with corporate PR statements surrounding the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis, and in a sense, the statement was fairly boilerplate. But because of the context of, shall we say, certain elements in the community who are rather aggressively not okay with the game reaching a diverse and growing audience, not only did the company need to take a side, but they needed to go the extra mile and explicitly say they don't want these people in the hobby. If the statement bothered you because it seems obvious and like it shouldn't need to be said, just look at the backlash and appreciate how many people feel entitled to exclude anyone they don't see as fitting into the hobby. Every community, whether it's a local store, an online forum, or a globe-spanning fandom, needs moderation to thrive. Toxic people drive away new interest, and we need to make an effort to cut them out. And one final note before we get into the main episode topic. Because currently, protests against police violence and misaligned budget priorities are ongoing in my city and many others. Necromunda seems lawless at first brush, but it is in fact a police state. On Necromunda, the ruling class keeps the people divided into competing houses, fighting each other so that no one can challenge the noble houses and guilds and their enforcers. If, under the right circumstances, the gang houses came together as one, there would be no stopping them. Not all the enforcers on the planet could stop an uprising in the billions. Things aren't so different here in the real world. The powerful want us divided and fighting each other so that we're easy to rule. They think we'll accept state violence and militarized police if we fear each other more than we fear the state. Racism, xenophobia, homophobia, sexism, etc. are tools of division to keep people from realizing what would be possible if we came together in mutual solidarity to fight for a better life for everyone. That's as far into real-world politics as I want to go right now. But with that, on to the rest of the show. With me is Ian Douglas, also known as Trash Wiz. You can find him on Twitter and Twitch and Facebook, and he does live streaming and such. You could better introduce yourself, I'm sure, Ian.
Yeah, sure. So I post on a lot of different social media accounts, but the main the main shtick, so to speak, is that I had was previously known for making terrain out of recycled materials, stuff that people would normally throw away. But I've sort of branched back into an older love that I had of working on homebrew rules, writing my own games. I'm, you know, definitely been dabbling in 3D printing as well lately, so I'm sort of wearing a whole bunch of different hats. But right now, it's just I've been working on this supplement that allows people to play sort of against a computer-controlled opponent for Necromunda as well as Warcry. I haven't forgotten Kill Team. Still need to work some kinks out of that. But yeah, I'm mainly here to talk about the Necromunda solo play rules that I cooked up.
So, Into the Dark, Necromunda solo play. What are we getting into with this? How much of a change is solo play for Necromunda?
I would say that it's less of a change than one might think. It's possible to take these solo play rules that I cooked up and simply dress up a second gang and play against them. So with a little bit of tweaking, you can just add a couple of new stats that I introduced for this system to existing gang stat cards. And that will allow you to sort of, you know, dress up a spare gang to be your opponent for any particular game. It makes them behave in a slightly random fashion. It makes it a little unpredictable. But for the most part, it makes for, you know, a similar experience to playing against another human opponent. In some ways, it resembles the way that Blackstone Fortress operates, where the enemy models have sort of a behavior table that they use. So I have a group of behavior tables that are generally applied to the enemy fighters. Depending on what kind of like personality or mind they might have, you use one of four tables for that.
Yeah, that was the thing that I thought was a really nice touch is, you know, Blackstone Fortress, each individual like type of unit had its own table, and while you kind of get used to it, it was a lot of like it was like literally each different like armament on the model has a different table of which actions it takes. So like it would just be this whole big kind of you're like having to pick each model, figure out which model it is, and then like go back. And it's a lot simpler when there's, you know, a smaller number of tables. It's not quite as invasive. And I feel like the reason Blackstone Fortress did that the way it was because there's a lot. You're outnumbered pretty heavily when you're playing that game. So you need to have kind of randomly the models not doing like the most effective action at any given moment. Otherwise, the players will just get overwhelmed and they'll die really quickly. Whereas in Necromunda, things are a little bit more evenly balanced in terms of the factions on the table. So you don't quite need as much stupid action out of the model, the AI, you know, in order to keep your players alive.
For sure. And the system that I wrote still has some stupid action worked in. So you're definitely going to find that the computer-controlled opponent is going to make some bad calls.
Sure.
So as the player, you're going to have a distinct advantage over the computer-controlled opponent if you're just setting up evenly matched gangs.
That's fair.
So I think the way this is going to work best is when you're consistently playing against fresh, full-strength gangs, using a gang that has suffered injuries and has people in recovery and whatnot. So sort of running like a mini campaign might be a good way to do that.
Right.
And then the other way to make this work is running it sort of like running a series of adventures where you are up against unknown odds, where you can't quite tell how many enemies you're going to be up against. And it can create situations where some games you're going to have sort of an easy time and you're going to be playing in a way to minimize your casualties.
Sure.
And in other games, you might be up against overwhelming odds like that Blackstone Fortress situation. That system also really works well. Talking about Blackstone Fortress, when the player only has, you know, one or two or three characters they're controlling,
right,
having more complexity to manage within the game makes it a little less boring. So having all those tables does make sense in that context. And having a table for every kind of model just doesn't work in the context of Necromunda when you have, you know, an almost infinite number of combinations,
exactly,
of different loadouts and fighters within the core gangs themselves. You know, when I was working on these rules, I was not only trying to make it compatible with the Necromunda gangs that we know, but also to let people use other 40K models that are in their collection.
Right.
You know, because a lot of us, not everybody in this hobby is going to have more than one gang, but we might also have a 40K army or Blackstone Fortress or some AOS models. or some Reaper figs or something else they can use. So I wanted to make this really flexible in what models you could use to be your opponents.
Yeah, I think that definitely when you're getting into something like solo play, giving people as many options as possible as just kind of a way to get their gaming fix in is definitely the best approach, because there's sort of the other way of doing things where like you're sort of custom doing everything very individualized. But I feel like that works best when you're sort of doing like a role-playing game kind of a situation, and you don't necessarily want that level of specialization in your rules when you're dealing with something so open-ended. It's more of a toolkit and less of a preset kind of adventure.
For sure. And right now it is a little more of a toolkit in the state that I have it posted currently.
Mm-hmm.
But I plan to pretty shortly, and it may be up by the time this episode is live, I plan to include some common, I don't want to say common stats, but I'm going to be looking at basically the Necromunda rules that are already out, figuring out what types of fighters we have stats for, and then giving them recommended behavior tables. So what mind stat they should have, it tells you what behavior table to look at,
right,
for the different gangs, for the different fighters, and then giving people guidelines for what special actions to give them. Because a lot of like the skills and war gear, it's pretty hard to work those into a behavior table.
Sure.
So I have this system where each fighter has a couple different special actions when they're a computer controlled opponent. Mm-hmm. And depending on how desperate their situation is, they'll use one or the other. So a computer controlled opponent that isn't badly outnumbered is going to use one. And then if they're outnumbered like 2-1, they're going to fight more aggressively, and they're going to have a more intense a special action that might come up in their behavior table.
I like that. That's a good idea.
That's like great, creates an opportunity for them to use grenades, for them to maybe use something like a grapnel launcher.
Right, right.
And you can even do push the limits and sort of work in something you'd expect to see on a tactic card as one of those like desperate special action options.
Right, because you're not necessarily going to want to juggle tactics cards for your opposing team in that.
Exactly.
That is sort of hard to choose when, because you don't know when you're writing the table up which tactics cards they'll have. So how would you possibly integrate that into to automate? Yeah, that's a clever idea. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you were playtesting this, how did you find that the system works? Did you think that it was sort of a quick and easy kind of setup and playthrough, or did you find that it took a little bit of work to get things down as you were playing through it?
So this definitely takes some time. Setting up, I really quickly sort of printed out the rules that I had. I had mocked up a scenario that I wanted to run solo for myself. And the scenario is in sort of a rough state for my first round of playtesting. So
sure.
There were some things I needed to fill in. Once I was set up, the scenario that I ran, it was meant to be a beefier scenario, so it took me about 4 hours to play through solo. But it was one of those scenarios where, like, you're going to have your full, like, 1,000 credit starting gang on the board, and it's one of those scenarios where you're going to be up against overwhelming odds by the time the scenario is coming to a close. So, I wanted to create a scenario to test that felt like a full play session, felt like a proper gaming experience, and it really delivered on that. This first adventure that I cooked up is not going to be something you can sit down and play quickly.
Right.
But if I were to sort of splice in the rules for the gang raids, where you're using basically like half a gang, like a champion and like a couple other fighters, you could probably play a scenario using these solo play rules against a similar opponent, in about an hour or two. I would even say you could do it in less than an hour if you've done it before.
I was going to say that the gang raids really are nice and concise, and they achieve that both through a small play surface and through a smaller total overall number of models on the table. I definitely find that the most like heavy influence on how much time a game takes winds up being how big your play surface is and how many total models you have to move. Like I have noticed consistently when the gang goes over 10, the game lengths start really stretching out as each player has to juggle more and more elements and decisions become harder and such, because you're just trying to coordinate a bigger, you know, picture. Whereas when you're dealing with four or five models, it's just very easy to knock out your turn because it's like, all right, this guy, your guy, this guy, your guy, and we're done. Like,
for sure. And there was definitely an element of, you know, the game being slower when people are making tougher decisions. Mm-hmm. So one of the nice things about this rule set is that you're the only one actually making decisions. There, you don't have to really wait for an opponent to think.
Exactly.
Now, there is something that sort of eats up that time, which is, you know, the first few times you're going to sit down and use these rules, it's going to take a while before you're comfortable with, like, eyeballing what situation the computer model is in and what parts of the behavior table will apply to them.
Right.
So at the beginning, it does sort of take up a similar time to playing against a human opponent, just because you're figuring out, okay, what is it that they're actually supposed to do with this rule that I just made? But again, once someone is a little more comfortable with that, a little more familiar with the table, by the time I was rounding out that session, I was finishing the turn in half the time as I was at the start. So maybe on someone's second or third scenario for this system, they'd have it down so that a game would probably play maybe only two-thirds of a time of a game against a human opponent, or maybe less. It depends.
Fair enough.
There's also like the nice benefit too, and this is something I experienced literally yesterday, is that if you're not playing against a human component, you can stop anytime you want and go have lunch or grab a beer, or as long as you make a little note of like whose turn it's supposed to be and you have a really clear marking system for what models have activated and what haven't, then you can step away and then come back to it as long as you can leave it set up.
Yeah, that's something that I've noticed with Blackstone Fortress, because my son is six, and so we play Blackstone Fortress together, and he definitely has a endurance limit for concentrating on a game. So longer than an hour, and it's definitely not feasible, but he likes to play, you know, through the real game. So those missions usually take longer than an hour. So we just leave them set up on the board downstairs. And then when we come back later, we finish.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, that's definitely an advantage for those playing against, you know, non-human opponents for sure.
Yeah, I think that it's a clever thing to kind of offer. And I've noticed that, you know, at its base, your system is capable of using the core missions from the game without having its own, you know, you don't have to have, by definition, a set scenario going in. You know, it's designed to work with the game missions with some exceptions, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So if you're playing really any scenario where your opponent is just trying to kill you, those will all work just fine with this rule set. So it's just that the behavior tables aren't set up in a way to be sensitive of objectives. They right. can't prioritize capturing something. They don't even really have a good target priority system necessarily. It doesn't evaluate threats. So on a scenario where like you're trying to escort a prisoner or trying to escape through the enemy's faction or through their deployment zone, yeah. those will all still work because, you know, they're going to try to kill you and they might succeed. So, you know, most of the scenarios in the book are going to work just fine. And some of them that might not work if you're the attacker will work if you're the defender.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it and like even some things that are, you know, simple objectives like in the what's that one? The border dispute where there's like the gang icon to defile.
Yeah.
Not only does the game work without actually involving, like you could play the scenario and ignore the icon and, you know, a good chunk of the time you're going to play just fine because the icon is, you know, in your backfield and in your opponent's backfield. And odds are that you're going to, one of you is going to bottle before you can actually get over there and defile the thing.
For sure.
But even that, like you could have a rule where, you know, if something that overrides where it's like if the model is in base contact with the icon when it is the start of their turn, then don't roll, they'll defile the icon. And you could just include like, you know, you don't have, that doesn't even have to be written into the core scenario rules. The person who's playing the game could just, you know, think about what the model's, you know, orders would be or whatever and go from there.
Yeah, you could also work in, if you leave the special action slot open on a few of the models that you're creating to be your opponent, it wouldn't be hard to come up with some special actions that you can sort of attach to computer-controlled opponents for specific scenarios.
Right.
So because special actions on the behavior table are sort of interspersed semi-randomly, depending on what mind we're talking about, what type of behavior table we're using, you could have the computer-controlled opponent go for that objective every time their special action comes up. Yeah, it would be possible to make that a little more flexible and let them go after the icon if they're close to it, or let them treat that like an enemy that they have to get into close combat with to hurt, and then all of the other options work just fine. You can look at the table and based on their situation, they're too far away from the icon and they're not within range of any other enemies. Yeah, they're gonna move aggressively towards the icon and they're gonna defile it. That's gonna be their behavior. So
yeah, exactly. Since you're the one who's sort of orchestrating everything as the single player, you can definitely try to add a little bit of common sense when you're trying to incorporate something like objectives that's hard to write into the actual script of the rules. Just think outside the rules a little bit and just sort of do your own judgment about when you think that it's a good idea to, have guys going after that.
And I do encourage people to do that, like in the body of the rules itself.
Right.
You want to sort of play the rules with the spirit of the rules in mind, where you want them to be a challenge. Sometimes that means, not moving the enemy model exactly where they would end up if you follow the rules to a T. Maybe like tucking them like an inch and a half to the left so they're behind the barricade instead of out in the open, or maybe making it so that they might, shoot at a slightly more dangerous fighter that's just as easy to hit. So you can definitely make things harder on yourself. I would recommend people not making it easier on themselves, though. That's one of the things where it's like really difficult to resist the urge to just, softball it a little bit. When I was like first proposing these rules, I had some folks on Reddit on some other platforms as well that were like, well, why couldn't you just set up a gang and control both gangs and have them play against you to the best of your ability?
Sure, which is, the playing chess against yourself approach.
Yeah, and it's hard because it's hard to get outside of that space where you want to win and you're going to sort of attach to one side or the other. So if you're controlling both gangs, you can easily sort of create a trap for yourself that you'll just fall into subconsciously, not even really thinking about it. But when you have a table that's determining the behavior of your enemy fighters, the table might make them behave in a way that you wouldn't think of. That right. might not be like the best play objectively, but it might put you in a really tough spot. That was something that I experienced in my playtesting yesterday, where the enemy behaved in a sort of an erratic way that didn't quite make sense, but it put the enemy in a position to completely hose like a full turn of my actual plan as a player.
Right. Oh yeah, that's definitely something that when you play against players, you do get a sense for how they play, and you can kind of, not necessarily predict what they're going to do at any given time, but you get a feeling for the people you play with regularly for what their approach is, how they handle threats, how they respond, and you're totally throwing that out when you have a randomized system. You're not going to know at all, without at all reliability, which move the opponent is going to make. And that definitely throws a wrench into any, strategy planning that you're doing.
For sure. And when you're playing against a human opponent, you know what their objective is. You're going to expect them to behave in a rational way. They're not going to throw away a turn here and there. And sometimes performing an action that's less optimal is going to be more effective if everything involved is sort of random. Plus, I feel like when I'm playing against other players, sometimes like the role-playing feel of the game sort of falls away, and they're having fighters take actions that they wouldn't normally take. Like, Juve's just throwing themselves at my fighters to get slaughtered to be a distraction. Those fighters might not do that, in a role-playing context. But because a Juve was going to use the amateur behavior table that I've set up in the computer-controlled situation, those fighters are more likely to take actions to preserve their own lives. So they're going to be more likely to move for a barricade instead of going right for you. They might even make themselves prone instead of shoot so that they don't get hit. They might duck into a corridor or flee from melee when, like, you know, taking that like extra chance to make an attack might actually be more effective.
Right.
Because I'm thinking, like, you know, what would an inexperienced fighter do if they're already wounded, which is one of the rows? They might just bail. They might just run away from you. So, you know, those behavior tables will create some behaviors that you won't get from a human opponent because it's a bad play. But it, from a narrative perspective, it feels good.
Right. So I guess this is a good segue into talking about what are the four types of tables that you have?
Yeah, so I have amateur and experienced, which are the two that you're going to see most often. Amateur refers to a humanoid fighter that just doesn't have a whole lot of experience. So for most gangs, I would say juves and even gangers would fall under that category. So those are going to be people that aren't necessarily hardened fighters. They probably wouldn't have any advancements if they're going to be in that category. They picked up a gun, they have some training, but they're still going to be, you know, anxious about situations. They might hesitate, they might flee, they might hide into a corridor for a turn if they're starting to panic. It helps fill in for the fact that frequently your computer control opponent, you might not want to mess with bottling rules, so it can sort of take the place of fleeing mechanics a little bit. Then the experience table. Oh yeah, go ahead.
That's an interesting point about not necessarily wanting to use the bottling mechanics as built in when you're doing a solo scenario. There's definitely mixed bag with bottling where it can make a game end way faster than you intended to. Which is, you know, something that you could kind of work on with your opponent. But when you're setting up by yourself, definitely having, you know, all the time and energy put into setting the models up, having them walk off the field after the second round of shooting definitely does not feel like as satisfying of an experience.
For sure. I mean, like, you're setting this up so that you can play against somebody. What are they going to do? Run on turn three? You don't want that. You put in all that work. So then when we move on to the experienced behavior table, that represents anyone who has climbed a bit in terms of like battle experience. Your gang leaders, your champions, your specialists are going to fall under that category, and so would any bounty hunter that you would throw on the other side of the field. An experienced table is going to have a little more of an aggressive twist. The times where an amateur fighter might run away from the nearest enemy, an experienced fighter might actually move towards the nearest friendly model. So some of those roles might not be great from it, like in terms of effectiveness for them killing you, but it creates these situations where a pure random system, a fighter is not going to be able to move to someone who's seriously injured to assist them on a reliable way. Those experienced fighters, and in some ways the amateur fighters too, I find that they consistently will move towards each other every once in a while, and that can lend them a hand to get those seriously injured fighters back up. It happened multiple times during the game I tested yesterday. So on top of that, when you're building your amateur fighters and your experienced fighters, giving them special actions that reflect like what their ability should be and their experience level are all worth doing.
Right.
I like to sometimes give my amateur fighters their normal special actions, sometimes wasting their action, like literally a do-nothing action, if they're meant to overwhelm you, and an inexperienced fighter might hesitate in a situation. And then giving them in their desperate action slot something more aggressive. Whereas in the experienced fighters, you want probably both of those slots to do something meaningful, unless they're meant to be such a strong fighter that they shouldn't even be there, or you shouldn't even be fighting them. Then for the other page, I have animal and mindless behavior tables. Those are going to be ones that won't see as much use. Animal is going to apply to anything that has less than a humanoid intelligence. So a lot of our pets, a lot of our sump monsters, and some of our wild Xenos creatures are going to fall into that animal category. I would even go so far as to say is that some mutants that people might throw together or kitbash is going to be in that category too. It's a little more erratic than the inexperienced table. There's definitely some lines on that table that is a little bit like head scratching, like why is it doing this thing? But part of that is because, you know, an animal is going to preserve its own life as well, but just not in as coordinated as a way as an inexperienced fighter might. And then on the mindless table, that's going to be your servitors, your zombies, things that might be above a human intelligence could even fall under that category where you're not sure why it's doing what it's doing.
Something like a spindle drone or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's like perfect slot. Or I can't remember what they're called, the Blackstone Fortress enemies with the zap coils that are like heavily augmented. Oh, yeah. I put them in the mindless category thinking, oh, yeah, they look sort of like servitors. We'll just use them to test that out. And then the mindless category is the one where they're frequently making either random movement or really aggressive movement, even if they're wounded or outnumbered. They're like the Terminator. They just keep crawling towards you. Even when they're seriously injured, they'll always crawl towards the nearest enemy fighter, which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, that makes for an interesting situation where you're being swarmed by people who can't actually charge you. They just want to get to you.
Yeah, but it's that too has come up where it's like, okay, they're seriously injured and they're crawling towards you. Great, I can coup de grace them. But then if they recover and they're within an inch of you,
you're engaged.
Like, yeah, now they're engaged, and that's probably right where they want to be.
That makes sense. I was just thinking that these rules, while they're definitely like great for solo play, they can also be really useful for adding a non-player character element to a battle, whether you're talking about, I have been working on some of the Raptorix from Warcry to use as like Ash Waste birds. I was going to start throwing them into missions where like, cause I was planning an Ash Waste campaign to start this summer. Obviously that's been delayed a bit, but once we finally get around to it, I definitely want to include some missions where the players are fighting over something, and then there is another opponent on the table that is not interested at all in what their mission is and just wants to eat them, or, you know, just wants to keep intruders out of their nesting grounds or whatever it is. And I definitely had been making a lot of the calls about how the models act in those kind of scenarios myself as the arbitrator. But it would be more fun and more fair if I was using a table for all of that instead.
For sure. It removes some of the partiality that an arbitrator sometimes has. Like, if you're an arbitrator and you're also playing, it's really hard to make impartial decisions on who those computer-controlled, who those, like, neutral enemies are going to attack. So I think the Warcry system that like is sort of built into that game, where like a person can activate a computer controlled opponent that sort of behaves semi-randomly, is a neat solution to that. But having these random tables is another way to incorporate that, where no one is actually making those decisions. They're just doing what they're doing. And there's like clear rational ways that people can agree, okay, yep, that is how they're going to behave based on what you rolled. That's a neat solution. I was thinking, like, you know, with these rules set up, you could easily have games where a couple of players or even three players will team up against a computer controlled monster or computer controlled gang or force. And to take that a step further, you could even take two computer controlled forces and not actually play and have them like AI against each other.
That would be fascinating. I used to do that with StarCraft when I was a kid.
Simulator.
Exactly. I definitely, when I started sort of doing my own NPC scenarios, my first influences were from the sentry scenarios in the main book, where I didn't really like them for player versus player games, because I found that they were, it really removed a lot of the ability of the opposing player to take actions, and a lot of the scenarios ended pretty quickly. So I found that they were kind of a mixed bag and maybe not the most fun when you could only get one game in a night. They were totally fine if you had time to roll up a second game once you were through the sentries, but it was definitely not an ideal way to play like one versus one. But when I started using the sentry rules for a non-player opponent that was, you know, the other players were sneaking into a, you know, a depot or something and trying to steal stuff. It was a lot more fun because the both players were trying to outcompete each other while also not triggering this big, you know, conflict with the guards. And so from there, I just kind of started adding more and more. And it definitely was a fun process. But the one thing that's really missing is behavior tables. So I definitely am going to try to incorporate some of this stuff into the missions that I'm doing going forward.
Actually, and that gives that comes to mind another pretty good idea. The computer-controlled opponent rules that I have written up right now, they all operate under the assumption that the enemy knows where you are. And it hadn't occurred to me to work in a system or a situation where they might be acting more like sentries, where you could avoid detection for a certain period of time. I'll definitely have to like think about that maybe for, you know, a future draft or a future add-on to that system.
Yeah, and the built-in sentry rules do a good chunk of that, you know, since they're looking at like where the model is versus where potential targets are, and does the model notice whether that model is there and stuff. So a lot of the hard work on that front has been sort of taken care of by GW. It just needs for some tweaking, because it definitely is at a disadvantage for the sentry player.
And I would want to work in, you know, the idea that the enemies might not know where you are rewards people that might be trying to tackle like a little solo campaign. It might reward them for taking those silencers and those, you know, gas weapons and things that wouldn't detect the enemy.
That was part of the reason I started writing those missions, because I was like, they're like the sentry missions I wasn't a huge fan of, but I wanted to give people a reason to, you know, buy some different types of war gear, or to advantage the players who already had, you know, flechette pistols or whatever, and not have, you know, that rule that you're paying for in the points cost go completely unused. So
the fact that Delac has easy access to those pieces of war gear ends up being a drawback for them if they can't ever use them.
Exactly. Just like you got to include sometimes the power goes out or whatever and you're in the dark. Because otherwise, why buy all of those cool pieces of tech that help you see in the dark?
Yeah, unless you're turning the lights off yourself, and then everybody like starts to counteract that. Yep. And yeah, it becomes an interesting mess.
Yeah, so it's definitely something to think about for future updates. But you have anything else, any other thoughts on this system that you've devised here?
If you don't mind, talk a little bit about the adventure, or rather the scenario that I cooked up that I will be publishing here soon, probably shortly after this coming weekend. So I would imagine that would be before this episode drops. But the scenario that I tested yesterday was one where your gang is attempting to escape from a bunch of deserter guardsmen. So I'm using the Blackstone Fortress enemies for the enemy models in this. And I experimented with a few things that are sort of reaching beyond the initial rule set that I wrote, where I've sort of broken down Blackstone Fortress models into like 500 credit-ish sized encounters. Mm-hmm. And the way that this scenario works is that you're trying to guard this servitor while it repairs and turns on a lift so that you can escape. So you're trying to protect this sort of neutral model. It has to make intelligence checks to repair it. You have a way of assisting it, but like you can't make it take more than one action in a turn. So you can't like cut the game in half in terms of like turn limit or whatever else. But basically, you have to successfully do it like 5 times. So it's like a play on randomized turn or randomized game length, where the more times you fail, the longer the game's going to actually last. And then you start with just one of those 500 credit encounters on a side room behind a closed door, and there's like 3 of such doors, and it's random where they get deployed, so you can't really prepare for where they're going to sort of pop out from. And beyond that, you can't prepare for which 500-point group is going to show up either. So I've broken them down into like 3 different detachments, 2 of each, and randomly one will start, and then at the end of turn two, and every turn from that point forward, another one deploys in one of those random rooms until four of them have been deployed, in which case on the turn following that, the Chaos Space Marines get deployed. And they are there to just whoop you. Like, if you haven't left by the time they're close,
right,
it's over.
Of course.
Because they're Chaos Marines. And what ended up happening in my playtest game was I was so very close to just barely escaping with like two of my champions and nobody else, because like one by one they would drop people, and they'd get seriously injured, they'd be flesh wounded up so that they'd basically be doomed. And like eventually I just bottled, the two champions fled, the servitor was seriously injured, it like crawled onto the lift, and then it got like coup de grace by like an enemy fighter like on the last turn, right when the lift was gonna leave. So like that was one of those cases where it's like I know like I pretty much have that dialed in, because I think I'd failed to repair the lift three times, and like on a five up, because it was assisting the servitor on two dice. That's rough.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can't, like, there's always going to be times where you lose because of bad dice rolls. That's impossible to write out of your system.
Of course. But, like, you know, that little test showed me that, you know, it's going to be a challenge. It's a scenario that's meant to be won, but it's one of those things where it's like, how much of your gang can you save?
Exactly, right. Winning is not the same thing as like getting everybody out alive.
For sure. So I tested it with my Cawdor. It wasn't like an optimal build, but there were definitely a few points where it's like, boy, am I glad I took that. Like the heavy crossbow. There was multiple detachments that deployed in a room that was literally down the hall from my deployment area, where like when they open the door, I have a line of sight to almost everybody.
So just and fire those things down.
Exactly. I just kept putting like frag missile after frag missile after frag missile in that room, and they still ended up basically shooting me to shreds just because of people with like las guns. That would randomly, okay, I'm standing, I'm going to aim and shoot because that's what I roll on the table, or it walks up or walks down to a valid action, and that was the closest one.
If playing Escher has taught me anything, it's that you should not underestimate the power of 5 to 10 las guns.
Oh, yeah. And there were situations where, like, the Beastmen or the, like, traitor sergeants that just have, like, a las pistol just totally gacked people. because they were in a good position, they did aim and shoot, they're going to be hitting on like twos or threes, and I just, you fail your flak armor save and it's done. Yep. Like, that's that.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it's a numbers game, you know, las pistols don't do much, but when you're rolling a, you know, relatively low to hit number, eventually you're going to take somebody out. It's just a matter of time.
Mm-hmm. And in playing that game, there were a lot of like little moments that were really cool from a narrative standpoint. There was a point in the match where the Chaos Marine with the Thunder Hammer was like walking down the hall, and like the other like computer controlled enemies, because they weren't desperate at that point, when they were doing special actions, they would like duck behind cover or hesitate because they're inexperienced, and like I wanted to give them sort of something of a drawback. Right. But it sort of makes sense that they would like cower from this dude with a thunder hammer and a plasma pistol that's like 8 foot tall walking down this hallway. You know, you don't want to be near that guy, even if he's on your side. Like, you don't want to get in his way, you know, all that other stuff. And there was a moment where one of the beast men, I gave him a special action, lets him like run and then jump. And he kept doing this thing where he would jump into combat and then flee from combat as his two actions. And it's like, oh, what a bad choice that is, because he's sort of a close combat character. But that is what led him to like engage my crossbow character in close combat, and then eventually engage the servitor in close combat, like way behind my lines.
He's doing this kind of crazy leaping moves.
Yeah, and it wasn't optimal, because like he could have just attacked when he got into close combat instead. But no, he was just working his way behind to a point where I just couldn't.
The big threat, and he wanted to take the big threat down, the crossbow.
And that was all thanks to the animal table being just very erratic.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have any shout outs you want to do before we go?
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to give Dragon's Rest a shout out. I've been playing on their Sector of Fatalis tiles for my playtests, and I've been printing those out for a while. And it really sort of like spiced up the little Zone Mortalis board that I put together. The Games Workshop tiles have been really inconsistent in terms of whether or not you could get them, the plastic ones. And it was just a really nice alternative to have something a little grittier, a little with a 3D element to play on rather than just the 2D
mat. Yeah, it's funny. The one thing from Dragon's Rest I haven't printed yet is the floors. I've been doing the walls for the Nova tiles, but because I was doing four tables, I needed as low of a plastic floor tile as possible. So I found one that had, you know, it's like a grating that had holes in it because I was mounting everything on insulation foam. So the only thing I haven't printed of theirs yet is the floor tiles, but I'm about to finally start working on my own Zone Mortalis board after finishing the four Nova ones. So I'm finally about to get into the Dragon's Rest floor tiles, but I love their walls. They're really a cool system.
Yeah, it's definitely worth playing around with. I've been printing the Fatalis Slim tiles for a while, and those are the ones that were specifically set up to be compatible with the Games Workshop Zone Mortalis stuff. And there is definitely a few quirks to work out. I managed to get them printing pretty smooth, but just the texture of the tile makes it so that the doors and some of the other terrain features don't quite mesh the way they should. So I, rather than mess with the tile, I actually tooled and messed with the plastic terrain because I think it's easier for me to fix a couple of lifts and a few doors than it is for me to, you know, print a whole other batch of tiles, right? But apart from that, it's great. They've been really good, they're pretty fun to paint. So I would recommend those if you've got access to a 3D printer, for sure.
Also, I would also recommend, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate
definitely.
It.
I'll definitely have to have you on sometime in the future. I'd love to chat 3D printing and building terrain and all that fun stuff.
For sure, and I have some other things that I'm cooking up that I'd love to talk about that I'm happy to, or love to talk about in a future episode that I'm happy to give you a little teaser for.
Absolutely.
So I brainstormed a while back some fixes to the Dominion or Law and Misrule style campaigns. My most recent one was a combination of both, where I sort of smashed the two systems together. You know, the number of people that have, you know, griped about the runaway game where, like, they win their first couple of games, they might have picked a couple of skills that get them some extra credits. We know what faction I'm talking about. And then they end up with, like, so much money that they can replace anyone they want. They can field however large of a game they want. It doesn't matter because they can roll in with their, like, 2+ armor saves and plasma cannons and whatever else they feel like. It all boils down to the things that they are doing to win the campaign line up with the things that make them more effective against in their next few battles. And like that doesn't add up. That won't make for like a good experience unless everybody's on the same page about like how narrative they're gonna play.
And even if they are all playing narrative, like in my group, for example, it was all new players other than me. And so they didn't know going in that they were making OP choices or whatever. But you accidentally stumble on stuff because you like,
for sure.
You're like, oh, that sounds cool. Let me buy two of those. Oh.
Yeah, I can't count how many games I've won just because I, like, oops, got blaze markers on three guys, and then they just lose a turn, basically.
Yep.
So, the one of the tweaks I'm going to be making when I'm looking at that is I sort of got a little bit inspired by the Dark Uprising campaign mode where the territories have a ruined version that's a little less effective. Something in between that and the way that the deck building card game Dominion works. In that game, in order to win, you're basically like you're building a deck that lets you take more actions, that gives you more money, that lets you buy cards, but none of those cards help you actually win the game. You have to have like victory point cards in your deck to win, and those cards basically do nothing when you draw them. So they make your deck worse by adding them, but you need them to win. So in that game, at a certain point, you have to change gears and start playing to win instead of playing to make your gang or your deck stronger. Now, rather than giving people the choice to say, okay, I'm going to stop earning credits and start earning victory points, because then it becomes, okay, when do you make the decision? And if you make it right, you win the campaign. Instead, I'm going to be looking at changing the way that the territories and the rackets are set up so that at a certain point in the game, they become less useful. Mm-hmm. So either you get a certain, once your reputation is high enough, or once your wealth is high enough, or once you have a certain number of gangers, or when somebody makes a certain number of advancements, your card flips over, it stops earning as much money. Maybe it doesn't earn any money at all, and instead it's worth some kind of a victory point value for your gang, like prestige. Sure. And then at the end of the campaign, whoever has the most prestige worth of territory or gear or whatever else is the winner. But each territory is going to behave a little differently in when it decides to flip, and I'll maybe set it up so that some of them flip early and are worth more because, you know, it's going to be less helpful in the long term if you only get like two rounds worth of income before it stops being useful. And then once it flips, it won't ever flip back as long as you control it. So what that's going to represent is if your gang is big enough and strong enough, the people who are under your thumb might be able to get away with more. They might be able to like not give you as much of their earnings. They might think, oh, well, they've got so much territory, they can't watch us that closely. Let's maybe increase the prices at the trading post. You know, having some of those territories will eventually become a drawback for the stronger gangs, but only when they become strong enough where, you know, they might have an unfair advantage over the other players.
Makes sense.
And then on the other side of that coin, I'm going to come up with, I'm not sure if you're familiar with rubber banding systems, where this is a term that it makes me think of one of the earlier Mario Kart games, where the further ahead the person in the lead was, the worse their top speed became, and the faster everyone else's top speed becomes. So it pulls the person in the lead back, pushes everyone that's behind forward. And I know that like the house favor table is supposed to do that. I don't think it does a good enough job. So.
You know, I think that the original game actually did kind of think about that with the way that territories worked in the pre-2017 version, where territories had to be worked by models. So, like, the more territories you had and were trying to maintain, and obviously there was less variety of territories back then, but the more territories you had, the more work it was to keep up with all of them because you needed to have your champions alive, or you know, not injured at the end of your games in order to send them to work those territories. So it became a game where, you know, you might have to play cautious with your models that had the best gear and not put them in situations where they could use them most effectively, because if they lost them, then you weren't getting that income.
Yeah, and I do recall that too with the just like the campaign system that was added just for Gang War, where you needed your leader and your champions in good health because working the turf is the main way that you got your income from them. So one of the things I'm going to be looking at is when players are earning a lot of income or getting a lot of accolades, it's going to generate some kind of a resource for the other players so that the players that are further ahead are almost digging their own grave in a way. I don't want to make it feel like they're like getting nerfed, so I don't want to like decrease income for winning a scenario if their blah size are bigger. But it'll definitely be a mechanic I'm going to add where the people that are further behind are going to get a disproportionately big payout, and it won't be tied to them winning a game or them even necessarily playing a game. It'll just be something that just get handed because, you know, their rivals are getting stronger. They're going to need a little leg up. Representing like whatever bigger forces are backing them. If you're a gang, it's going to be your house.
I like that idea because while the sort of Band-Aid inducement system or you know, the house favors or whatever, the one thing that it does that I find to be troublesome, at least in the games that I'm playing, is it tends to increase the model count pretty substantially of the player who's down. Because the hive scum and whatnot are not exactly expensive models. And so it winds up creating a situation where, you know, gangs are going over the number of intended models for a scenario, where the game is suddenly, you know, going significantly longer period of time because you've added, you know, five models to a gang that was already 12 models, something like that. So it's definitely I like the idea that, like, to have an alternate system that evens players out, that's not quite so... it's not quite as simple as, like, all right, take these five extra guys that you're gonna, like, recruit for this game and then they'll go away.
Yeah, and I do think that the most of the legwork in this set of tweaks I'm gonna work on is gonna come from the fact that right now what makes gangs run away is that the first few wins give them more income every single game, and that has to stop if that system's gonna get fixed. Because, you know, how are you going to beat somebody who even like two games in has an extra 500 credits over you? And it's only going to get worse every game from that point forward until you can start like fighting each other for territories they control. And by then, it's there's no way you can reverse it. So, like, you know, one of the top things I'm going to be tweaking is those territories need to not be earning income every single game once you're at a certain strength. So you'll still want them because those are going to be what lets you actually win, but that won't be their purpose anymore at that point. There will also be sort of like a fun system where if I'm a weaker fighter and I take a territory from somebody that had previously flipped over and stopped earning income, if I'm a weak enough gang, it'll flip back and I'll be able to earn that income because I'm smaller, I can keep an eye on them, maybe I'm going to be a little rougher with my contacts there, that kind of thing. So that's one project that I've got brewing. The other one is one where I'm going to be looking at coming up with a campaign system that instead of being one where you meet every week, everybody gets a game in, which is, for some people, it's too much of a time commitment. They've got to maintain their models. They've got to be playing every week. They've got to stay up to date with the rules. Not everybody can commit what amounts to like 8 hours a week or more sometimes, because, you know, 4 or 5 hours playing, communicating with your players to figure out who you're going to play with, doing your income, all of the jazz, right? And when I was preparing for Gen Con, rest in peace, because that's been canceled, I was trying to come up with a way to have people get together for a session that's just one really good game that can stand it on its own as a good experience without just it being a skirmish game, because, you know, you don't really get the feel of any role-playing or any development with skirmish. You sort of show up with, like, the toughest gang you could buy with your credits and with your limitation, and it becomes more of a tournament, and I kind of want to shy away from that. So I've been working on this system where a small slice of the session is actually players working on the story of their gang actually getting to the destination before the fight actually starts. So it's going to be from the context of basically each player's gang is in a comfortable place. They've got good turf. They've got an established pecking order. There aren't gang wars in that campaign. But instead, each player is basically sending an expedition out to check something of interest. Maybe they're all trying to hunt a bounty of some infamous person. Maybe a dome opened up that has full of riches. A bunch of gangs are going to send a cohort to go see if they can get the thing, see if they can find out what that they can find out. And one of the backbone systems I want to work in is I want people to be able to play really whatever gang they already had in whatever state it was in. So if they played a Dominion campaign, they've got a veteran gang, maybe it's huge, they'll be able to use it, and somebody else will be able to use a fresh gang, their 1,000 credit gang that doesn't have any rep, and find a way to even the scales between the two using that system of having that small role-playing adventure where they actually go from point A to point B. So I'm working on this sort of, I would call it a choose-your-own-adventure tool, where depending, you basically use a system to evaluate how strong your gang is. So, like, your rating is going to be assigned a value. How many rare gear pieces will be assigned a value? Your number of advancements will. Your reputation will. And this will sort of equate to a score that determines, you know, how tough your encounters on the way there are supposed to be. And these are encounters where it'll be a prompt. There will be a few choices that you can make. Some of them might be tied to a check of some kind. But it'll be these little, like, choose-your-own-adventure type situations where you're really trying to, like, role-play from the perspective of your gang's leader. You know, you're traveling with your gang. This is a situation. Make the call. Right. And then whatever happens, there's going to be consequences. What it'll equate to is some gangs are going to get there first. Because if they're a smaller gang, they can take less known routes. They can avoid detection. Those routes will be safer and probably quicker. If you're a big gang, you can't just crawl through the tunnels. You're not going to fit. Your fighters won't want to do it. They're experienced. They're wealthy. Why would I go through the sump to get there? Like, so basically what will happen is if a gang wants to get there fast, a weaker gang can do that unscathed. A stronger gang is going to get heavy losses if they're trying to take quick routes. And the fighters that get there quicker will have a resource to spend if they get there before anybody else to prepare, maybe to get supplies from local merchants. And there's going to be a lot more uncertainty and randomness in that system. So the goal is to be sort of to tell a narrative story before the game even starts with the journey that your gang took to reach the destination of wherever you're having your adventure. And then you're going to have this scenario where players will pair off based on the order in which they arrive, which will naturally pair the weaker players against the weaker players, stronger against stronger. And when they arrive, we'll give them more choices of like what objectives they want to be playing for on their part of the board. It might give them choices of like rewards that someone couldn't earn if they arrived too late. So maybe like a crystal is degrading that's like powering this factorum. And if you want to steal it, you have to be one of the people that arrived, you know, within 2 weeks.
Right.
So, you know, that might be you. And if you get there before the other player, you're already going to have the crystal, and then you're going to be fighting for something different. So you've sort of like locked in that reward just because you took that fresh gang and the fast routes.
Right.
So it's going to be kind of complex, but the goal is going to be that an arbitrator might be able to spend a little more time preparing, like picking a module, letting everybody know the material they're supposed to know when they're building their gang. So like they'll know the prompts, they'll know what routes are available to them in a loose sense. And then there's going to be a lot of semi-random elements where, you know, players might not be able to prepare for the fact that, oh, that chamber is full of gas. Now you know if you have time to prepare, you can really quickly buy some respirators if you have credits on you. If you don't, well, this is the consequence. Maybe fight in a different section of the board if there's a section available that you can fight. So it'd be a way to get, you know, your whole playgroup together maybe like once a month instead of every single week to play these sort of detached one-off sessions. And then if you show up and you have a bad run, it won't matter as much because it's not like that will lead to a series of compounding losses later. You just didn't get that one prize, and then we're all going to go through that whole rigmarole of people maybe taking a riskier, faster route or spending their credits on the way or using time to prepare and set traps. It'll just sort of give people something similar to a fresh slate each time while they're developing the character and narrative of their models too. So that's what I've got on my plate right now.
That sounds really fascinating. I'd love to take a look at it once you're done and do a bigger segment on it. So I look forward to talking to you in the future, and thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, we'll get in touch later, and I appreciate you inviting me over.
Awesome. Talk to you soon.
This Helmar Day! Have we got a race for you? It's a straight up Underhive tunnel dash as the defending champion Lightning Hortense faces down newcomer Sleeve McDykel and six more of the most promising jackal racers in the northeastern quadrant of the Palatine Hive. We'll see obstacles, pitfalls, maybe even the occasional marauding mutant as the racers vie to be the first across the finish line. Last cycle we had 3 casualties and several explosions, so don't miss out! Helmar Day!
And that's going to do it for another episode. Thanks to everyone for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show on your preferred podcast platform. Give us a like on Facebook and follow the show at Dome Runners on Twitter and me at Crimson Oracle. If you check out the show notes, you'll find links to Ian's Twitch page, Trash Wiz, and the Alone in the Dark supplement. And don't forget, there's just a few weeks left for the show's first short fiction contest. Due by June 30th, the prompt is open-ended, up to 2,000 words in any topic you like, as long as House Orlok is featured. Send your submissions to thedomerunners@gmail.com with the subject short story contest. That's going to do it for this episode. We'll be back with part two soon. And as always, never cross the Water Guild. Those who do are rarely seen again.